This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are bringing you a special hour today with highlights from our series Stepping Up. For the last several weeks, we've been bringing you a set of conversations on leadership. As we all try to move forward from 2 years of isolation, stitch our communities back together, it felt like the right moment to ask, what does real leadership look like? Not just in politics, but education, religion, nonprofit work. And for us, the best way to answer that question is do what we do. Talk with people who are walking the walk. Talk to them about what it takes to lead, the biggest challenges or obstacles that might keep someone from leadership, and how we can all help clear the path for the next leader to take that step. So we created Stepping Up and brought you five folks in and around Greater Boston who are making deep change in their communities. First up, Doug Rao. He is the founder of the nonprofit grocery chain Daily Table. But Doug spent 31 years with Trader Joe's, the last 14 as president. He was the one responsible for bringing the small California chain to the East Coast, turning it into a major player in the industry. But it's the moment after that where we started.
When I graduated from Trader Joe's, I called it that because I was 56 and I you know, just ready for a change. I didn't know what I was going to do. I knew that I wanted to continue to be engaged because I knew that traditional retirement really wasn't going to be the satisfying payout window for me. And so I happened to have an opportunity at that time to participate in a brand new program at Harvard called the Advanced Leadership Initiative. So I did this 2-year fellowship there. And out of that, got to do a deep dive into one of the social challenges that we face, which is around hunger. It's around nutritional insecurity or food insecurity. And so my thought when I was looking to transition from Trader Joe's, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to still be engaged. And I knew it was probably going to be in some nonprofit realm. Originally, I thought I'd just sit on boards, but that wasn't very satisfying for someone who'd been so operational their career. And so when the opportunity to do the fellowship at Harvard came up, what drew me to that one was that it has as a condition, at the end of it, you're going to stand and deliver in front of your cohort and the faculty. What are you going to do about a problem?
So there are a couple things I want to dig into there. And I want to note, excuse me, that's when I met you, was when you were through that. And we talked a number of times in those couple of years. So two things. One, as you entered that program with this sort of victorious run at Trader Joe's under your belt, who did you think you were as a leader at that stage in your career?
Wow. Yeah. I thought that I was someone who had better lucky than good, been at the right time, at the right spot with getting to meet Joe Colombe, Trader Joe, and then getting to meet Peter Drucker and do the Drucker Institute. And
management and specialist, famous management guru.
Yep, and I got the chance to get my executive MBA with him. It turned out he was a big Trader Joe's fan, so we had many conversations about that. And I thought I was someone who was a fairly creative leader, someone who was a very capable leader. But I also by then started to discover, as we all do as we get older in life, that there were a number of things I wasn't very good at or I didn't enjoy very much. So it turned out one of them was I didn't really enjoy managing. And lots of details.
I'm sorry, that just kind of surprises me.
Well, I liked the idea of having a challenge and going to solve it. Like, hey, how are we going to grow Trader Joe's out of California? You know, so you write the business plan, which I did, present it to central management and the owners. They approved it. And then it's like, okay, lead forth the charge to Boston and then grow it throughout the East. And it was this, can it be done sort of, you know, and get that. Once it's up and really running, I don't think I have any great expertise in that. I think I'm okay, but not, you know, nothing outstanding. I think I'd come to realize I don't really actually enjoy that. And so it was really one of those things where, well, where could I lean into next that would be something I'd really enjoy, or I might be able to also take my learnings and my experience and put it to best use.
Okay, so that was the other piece on this that I wanted to ask you, because that was a time in the nonprofit world where the nonprofit sector here in Boston specifically, although other places as well, was beginning to recoil from the thought that people who had been successful in business could just come in and fix things in these complex organizations or complex social problems.
Yeah.
So did you just think you could come in and fix things at that time?
No, I really did. I didn't. As you know, Tiziana, that's why I sought out people in that. And at that time, you happened to have a position with a nonprofit, very well respected. And I sought out your advice,
yeah.
As you know. I sought out, as I did for many people. I thought that I fortunately was just lucky enough to know I don't really understand this world very well. And I also was quick enough to learn that, oh, the nonprofit world has a little different rule book than the for-profit world. You've got to engage far more, shall we say, you've got to get agreement and support from different stakeholders, whether it be the community. You know, usually if you're going to put a grocery store in a community, you don't go out and ask them, is it okay if we do this? You put it in, and then you welcome them, et cetera. But you don't have to go out and, like, get as many stakeholders' approval as when you're going to go do some social work. You usually have to, you know, engage with whether it be the political will, the community's will, making sure that there's enough of the resources in the community supporting this, because nonprofits run off of the support of a community in a little different way, I think, than the average for-profit.
Okay, so I'm going to pause there, and we're going to carve out some time here to talk about Daily Table for our listeners. Because I can imagine a listener saying, wait, I don't understand how a grocery store is social work, right? Mm-hmm. So let's start with what Daily Table is now.
Okay. So Daily Table is a nonprofit retail grocery store that is committed to and dedicated to bring affordable, healthy, nutritious food down into communities that otherwise might struggle to afford that. So as it turns out, part of the research that I did at Harvard really revealed that hunger in America is not so much a shortage of calories for the 49 million food insecure, it's a shortage of nutrients. It's that the stomachs are full, but they're full of basically higher processed, calorically dense, but nutritionally poor foods.
Because those are inexpensive and
they're
easily
very
accessible.
Expensive. Exactly. So the challenge is, how do we bring these communities, the fruits, the vegetables, the fresh produce, the clean dairy and protein, the particularly grab-and-go meals that aren't high in sodium, high in sugar, deeply, you know, processed or fried, how do we bring that in an affordable manner? Because there is no, quote, disposable income. We often talk about, you know, what part of your disposable income goes to food? Well, if you get to below the middle class and even the middle class today, there's not much you can talk about as disposable. It's trade-off income. And I know you've worked with this and you know this yourself, that it was really an understanding for me. It was going out and talking to the community and getting an understanding of how can we best help. So Daily Table today, in many ways, it's a hunger relief agency that masquerades as a corner food store.
I just want you to say that a second time.
Okay. We are 100% committed to hunger relief work, but we masquerade as a community food store. And the reason we do that, it wasn't my initial intention, like, oh, he did a retailer, Trader Joe's. Of course, he went and did a retail store. I actually had no intention of doing that. I had met with Catherine D'Amato, the wonderful head of Greater Boston Food Bank, which does great work. And my hope was to go around, collect all this food, extra food from the grocers in the area, bring it down to them, have them distribute it, and hunger would be solved. I was naive. I was uneducated on the real challenges of hunger. And it was in a conversation I had with Vicky Esquerra, who was the CEO of Feeding America at the time. And I had 2-hour-long conversations with her and her team. And it was in one of those conversations when I was asked, what's your biggest problem? And she said, 38% of the population that qualifies for our services don't use them. And when I started with this, was it because they're not aware of it? Is it marketing? Is it you don't have enough locations? Is it language? Is it distribution? Like, oh, Doug, no, it's so much simpler than that. They're ashamed.
Stigma.
They're embarrassed. So it's that idea of how do we create a way to engage with people in need that will give them a sense of agency, that will put the power in their hands instead of feeling I'm getting a handout. And the thing about retail that's nice is it's voluntary exchange. So they choose to come to us. We got to earn their patronage. So although we're a nonprofit, in essence, hunger relief, trying to really bring affordable nutrition to communities and people that otherwise couldn't have it, we need to do it in a manner that engenders a feeling of agency, like I can provide for my family, and second, does it in a dignified way because they have the power of the purse. We got to earn their patronage every day. And I like that. So that's, but, and we also, one of the things really important is we hire from the community, we pay living wage, both Boston's living wage and also in Cambridge City's living wage. We believe very much that all of us together can get this done, none of us alone. So we engage with lots of other organizations that we partner with.
All right. So, and today at Daily Table, you guys work really hard to make it possible for someone to purchase enough nutritious food for a family of, I think it's four or a family of two, on a budget of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, on a SNAP budget.
Yeah. So we test this. We just did this again recently, where sort of the litmus test of, are we delivering on our mission? Because anyone could be a low-cost retailer, you know, a grocer, and there's many of them, and there are many of them doing good work. But the question is, as the litmus test, could someone who's on SNAP, and they're literally, that's their only form of income, is I just have SNAP, and I have to use that to buy food. And anyone that's done the SNAP challenge, like our wonderful Congressman Jim McGovern, who's done this several times, and he's written about it, how tough it is. By the time you get about halfway through the second or third week, you're out of money, and you start eating foods you know are going to damage your health. So what we do is a litmus test where we check to make certain that you can get 2,000 calories, which is the USDA recommended allowance for the average adult. You can get 2,000 calories of healthy food, balanced with nutrition, not too high in sodium, et cetera, good fiber, protein. And we can get you to the end of the month with money in your pocket.
Okay.
And we just validated that again. So that's the one distinctive factor, perhaps. We also have programs like Double Up Food Bucks, where people can come in if they're on SNAP, they get 2-for-1 on produce and things like that.
All right. So now let's move into some of the leadership's lessons here from this transformation, which from afar as I watched you really struck me as developing a commitment to quality that was separated from perceptions about income, deserving neighborhood. Everyone deserves quality.
Right.
What was stupid hard when you tried to step up in this space that just shouldn't have been? One of the things that we're trying to learn is, where do we make it hard for people to step up? And we just shouldn't.
Yeah. Well, I'd say there were probably two things. One was preconceived notions. They're, you know, you don't even know you have them until you run into them, you know, until reality, you know, gives you a whack on the head. So a lot of preconceived notions. And some of it are preconceived notions, by the way, that are out there that other people have told me. Like I'd read over and over again that, you know, well, once people unfortunately get, you know, raised or addicted to a diet that's high in sugar and processed foods, it's just impossible to get it to change.
So other people's preconceived notions or
exactly.
bad beliefs,
which I bought
about
into
what the situation is or what was possible.
Yeah. So I also, of course, read that and go, oh boy, what do we have to do? We're going to have a teaching kitchen and we're going to have to do this and that. And it turns out that we now know from experience that if you simply remove the economic barrier, that a large part of the population will go, I'll definitely increase produce in my diet. And we actually have studies to show that that happens. I mean, really good, rigorous studies done by the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition showing that 27% more produce per visit is purchased through the Double Up Food Buck program. That people that were on SNAP before we introduced it and then after bought on average 27% more produce just because the economics.
Because when they could, they made great choices.
That's right. Exactly. So and then we also know among this population from lots of data that they tend to, if they buy it, if they choose it, they use it because they can't afford to waste food. That, in other words, they may not buy it a second time or third time, but if they're buying produce, they're tending to use it. So that's important.
So those were some tropes, so basically.
So one is just the preconceived notions. The second is that and this sounds sort of, but how tough it is when there's not a goal line, when there's not a clear and an immediate goal line of success. So I had lots of ideas about success, like, well, when we're economically viable. Well, for nonprofits fighting hunger, that's almost impossible. It's very hard to find anybody in America that's doing that. But I had this idea we'd have these stores and they'd become, you know,
self-sustaining,
break even. I mean, obviously there's no shareholders that are going to return anything. We're nonprofit, but they'd be sustainable. And that's been far tougher than we thought because it runs into the dynamic of either you're going to offer low, low, low prices, yet food often costs more, and also you're paying living wage, et cetera. So you end up with, we're going to cover a lot, and we do. We're world class on covering, you know, 65, 70% of our expenses, but we have to count on the grace of the community and the philanthropic world to keep us going. And that's something that is new and it was different. So I think there's the fact that this is a long marathon, not a 50 or 100 yard dash, that it's not a dash to profitability or a dash to some silver bullet, that this is part of a systemic problem in America. And as systemic problems, they're incredibly entrenched and difficult to deal with. And that you need to get your inspiration and encouragement from the daily small wins, the fact that every time someone comes in.
Yeah, let's stay there. So let's wrap on this idea of the long marathon, because part of our focus in these conversations is how do communities show up so that that leader takes the step, stays in the game. So what kept you in the game? 7 years. Now, almost, since you opened that first store, several years getting to the point of opening that store, how has your community kept you in the game?
You know, that's a great question. If I reflect on that, I'd have to say it's probably two things. One is having been raised as a kid who had himself a dad who was going to college, getting his doctorate, his master and doctorate, all the time up until I was 10, 11 years old. Last week of the month was thin. You know, we were poor. We were struggling students, grad student kids, right? And I remember what it's like to be hungry. I remember what it's like to not, you know, have much to eat. So there's that intellectual part of my brain. It's also down in my body. But more importantly, what really keeps me going is the whenever we walk into a store and you see the faces of kids, you have customers tell you how much it means to them and their life. And I've had people tell me stories that are really, truly goosebump experiences where what this has done for them and what this has done personally into their life, et cetera. Those are the things when you can see that impact.
You got to tell us one of those stories.
Well, I mean, gosh, there's so many. Okay, so so one is a gentleman came in and he had just been down to Cobham Square Health Center right down the street, and he had his annual visit. And he came back in and he said, I just want to let you guys know that I've been shopping here almost every day since you've opened because I've just replaced what I was eating for lunch with your prepared meals. And I've lost 75 pounds. I said, whoa, that's fantastic. He says, no. But the doctor says that whatever I'm doing, keep doing it because I'm now off of my diabetic medication. I was pre-diabetic. I was headed down this path. I was that close to becoming diabetic. I've turned the corner. He says, you can stop taking it. Whatever, just keep doing what you're doing. He said, you got your life back. And tears welled up in his eyes. And there's a great big, it was about 6'4" or 6'5", great big guy. And like, you know, can I give you a hug sort of thing. It was one of those experiences where you just went, this is what it's about. It's that ability to success is one individual at a time. And I think in the nonprofit world, sometimes we get too enamored by how many millions of pounds were recovered or how many tens of thousands of this, that, but what really keeps you going. I mean, the everyday grind, because this is tough work, is that person to person looking someone in the eye and realizing if there's any way I can possibly be of service and help you help your family and yourself, it's all worth it.
All right. And that is Doug Rau, founder and president of Daily Table and the former president of Trader Joe's. Doug, really appreciate your time. Thanks for having the conversation with us.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
Stay with us. When we come back, we move from a grocery store to the pulpit with Reverend Willie Bodrick II. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we come back to a special hour now from our series Stepping Up. For the last few weeks, we've brought you conversations on local leadership. It's all about talking with folks in and around Greater Boston who are making deep change in their communities. Up next, Willie Bodrick II. He is senior pastor at the 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. We tackled what it takes to serve your community with your heart and soul, especially in some of life's most challenging moments. We were speaking with him just days after the grocery store shooting in Buffalo, New York last month. So I started simply by asking him how he was.
I'm well. It's been a busy time, busy last few years. But, you know, as I'm continuing to push through these moments, as we're making it through it together, I think we're seeing some horizons, and hopefully we're working together to make that happen. But my family's well, and the church is doing well, and so we're thankful for that.
Good. As we planned this, it was before this weekend. And of course, then we have the grocery store shooting in Buffalo on Saturday. And you want to talk about a moment. And I guess I assume that that's something you have to address in your service, in your leadership, whether you want to or not, whether you're hurting or not, whether that's something you can handle in public or not. How do you get there?
Well, first and foremost, I think faith communities, particularly the church and the Black church, has always been a haven for tough conversations, particularly in times of trauma and deep grief. To be very honest with you, I was very angry this weekend, frustrated, but also angered, because we've seen the signs of this type of white supremacist violence and ideology not only be perpetuated, but end up with lives lost. And if you put it in the grander context of American history, this isn't a new thing. It's just new in its form here in our particular context. And as you go into spaces of faith, you know that there are questions. People are grappling with emotions. They're grappling, as I told them Sunday, we're grappling with our faith and our frustrations. You're grappling with what to say. How do you manage those moments? How do you deal with those times? How do you process the trauma, whether near or far? How do you grapple with the fact that we no longer have safe spaces? And as leaders, we have to think in different ways. I remember when Charleston happened. You know, we're a church
shooting in a church in church Charleston.
In Charleston, and I won't name the perpetrator, but you know that. That was one that was very jarring for our community. And we were on high alert across the country, particularly as a historic church that could be targeted. And so we're thinking in new ways, but we're also deeply, deeply hurt by what's happening.
So many things I want to ask you just from literally the last two sentences that just came out of your mouth. So a couple of them quickly. Why not name the perpetrator of that other shooting?
I don't want to give power to that. I'd rather give power to those communities who are working together to process those real feelings, to validate their anger, validate their troubles, validate the trauma, validate the leadership that is rising in the communities where they are. I think we should not celebrate those who have levied this type of violence. And I think there's enough out there right now that creates an atmosphere to encourage, but we don't want to give power to that. We give power to communities. We give power to faith. We give power to those whom we love, and I think that's who should be lifted up. And I pray for those communities in Buffalo, but those communities all across the country who've dealt with that type of trauma and violence.
You made a reference to the fact that that was an historic church. Yours is an historic church. It is, and it's a church with a big pulpit to fill, given that Martin Luther King Jr. preached from that pulpit. Although sometimes I think when we emphasize that, we underemphasize the everyday leadership of all the other pastors who have preached at that pulpit as well. In a moment like this, how do you think about the weight of that historic leadership there and representation there?
I find it as an honor. I'm humbled by the fact, you know, and I'm thankful for Dr. King. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, originally.
Yeah.
So the King presence in Mantra is greatly both appreciated, but also I contextualize it, right? There's no King without William Hunter Hester, without Matthew A. N. Shaw. You know, when you think about 12th Baptist Church, you can't talk about it without talking about Leonard Grimes in the 1840s and all the work that he did. You can't talk about it without George Washington Williams, who wrote the first anthologies of Black African-American history in this country. You can't talk about it without talking about all the other pastors, Reverend Michael Lee Haynes, Reverend Arthur T. Gerald. And so I find it as an honor that I'm able to walk in the footsteps of those who come before me and to continue a tradition of justice, of faith, of for us, that faith in Jesus Christ, and using that as a means to both speak towards the issues of our day, to create community and convene, but to liberate people spiritually, socially, and emotionally. And as a church, we stand on the principles of love, light, life, and liberation, and we hopefully are are working to do that work in our present time, you know. So that's exciting. And I don't really feel the weight. I'm just thankful for the opportunity.
So I don't mean to be silly with what I'm going to say next.
Fine.
I know you were not expecting a Harry Potter reference in the middle of all of this. But when you talk about these men of spirit and men of faith and historians who came before you, I think about that moment in the last chapter of the Harry Potter story when he's got to confront death and the people who loved him who have passed mm-hmm. are physically with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about when you were, I'm going to get a little choked up, I think when you were angry on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, are they with you? And do they talk to you? Or do you talk to them? And how do you use that history to deal with your own anger and figure out how much of it as a leader, a faith leader, mm-hmm. can and should be present in what you do next?
Yeah, I always consult first God and consult the spirit of the ancestors and what they've done to fight the moments in their day. You know, we're dealing with different challenges, but their challenges were just as great for them. The decisions, the words that they spoke had impact on both community and country. And I think the presence and the spirit of that place, when you're in that pulpit, you know you're not alone. And I'm thankful that I never feel lonely doing this work because I walk in a tradition of people who've been willing to stand up, speak truth to power, put the community first, and to make sure that what is said speaks to what people are experiencing. And that's the beauty of the preaching moment, where you can speak and articulate and bring life to what people are feeling, to both have a conversation is what we're doing. We're having a conversation and we're praying that God is imbuing us to actually think critically about what we are to do. What is our Christian responsibility? What is our human responsibility, not only to each other, but to the community in which we are situated? And I think that has been the blessing. I would even argue it's a relief in some ways. That we are able to come together and be able to speak and to put that into the space and lift it before the God we serve. And knowing that that as we work together, as we continue to fight against those injustices, that we don't fight alone and that we have a strong tower that keeps us strong in those moments.
What about breaking from the tradition when you need mm-hmm. to? Doing something differently than
yeah.
it's been? Especially, you know, eyes have been on you for a while because you're young. You get that youngin' thing, right? That people are pushing on all the time. And I don't know when that stops for you, by the way. You've been in leadership for long enough. I sometimes wonder, do we stop calling you young? I haven't stopped calling you young yet.
I'm hoping I'm still young.
But so how do you break? How do you break from those traditions when that's what the moment has called for?
I think you think deeply about what's needed for that moment. And one thing I've learned about leadership is leadership starts with love. Then it also ends in learning. But between the love and the learning, you got to be able to listen. I've listened. And I think because I've listened and I've loved and I've learned from people, when there have been moments where I've had to make decisions that break from tradition, that may be controversial, that may be different, people know where I am coming from. And I've been willing to engage those conversations in good faith, genuinely, openly, in community. And so, you know, I think of, you know, during COVID, we had a vaccination clinic in the basement of 12 Baptist Church. That was a very controversial topic.
Was it?
In our community, vaccines, period. Not only in the country, but in our community as well. And I knew that that was the right thing to do. I knew that we had to have those conversations. We did a fireside chat. You know, I don't have a beautiful studio, but I have a beautiful sanctuary where we brought in physicians. We brought in a physician to kind of answer live all the questions. And we stayed there as long as we needed to. It was on Facebook. It was on YouTube. It was on Instagram. We were there as long as needed to answer any questions, to correct any misinformation, to deal with the distrust, and to acknowledge the pain that the healthcare system has not always been a good partner to Black communities, particularly, and Brown communities as well. So we acknowledge that. We acknowledge the history as well as the present existence of how we're having difficulties engaging in community with our healthcare professionals. And so we don't want to disavow those people, but we also recognize that at the same time, this was a deadly moment. We were losing people throughout this pandemic. It was difficult. I funeralized many of people in ways that I think we have yet to even comprehend how that type of trauma of funeralizing people where we did not have real meaningful departure. We did not always have ritual as we knew it.
Couldn't see each other, couldn't say goodbye.
Zoom funerals. I did Zoom last rites. I was in a place one time, it was five people and the majority of the family could not be there. I saw sons and daughters who contracted the virus right before the funeral who could not come and had to watch their loved one, their mother, their father, their aunt or their uncle, grandparent be buried over video. That has a meaningful, real impact on people. And I think we're going to have to do a lot of work of healing in order to kind of restore ourselves from that moment. But what I knew in this difficult moment was that we needed to be on the front lines. The church needed to be present, active, visible on the front lines. I was one of the first people to go take the vaccine because I wanted people to see not only is it safe, but I'm willing to do this myself. I want to be in partnership with you. And beyond that, not only did I want to myself to be an example of that, I want to say, look, I want to be in community and make sure that we as a church are committed to both healing and providing hope. And that healing does not stop at just spiritual healing. It's also physical healing. We have many stories in the Bible that speaks about this physical healing that Jesus Christ does throughout the Gospels. And so I wanted us to be a part of that work. And though it was controversial, I think it blessed our community. Almost 2,500 people almost were vaccinated in 12 Baptist Church because that was a safe space. We created a place of comfort, and there was a place, there was opportunity to build trust, and that trust was present with our community, and I'm thankful for that.
So undergirding what you just talked about is this idea of leading by example, right? You went and got the shot first. When you're a pastor, I can assume, I'm Catholic, I wasn't allowed to be one. But when you're a pastor, I can assume that that leading by example is a way of life. Mm-hmm. So where do you laugh? Where do you giggle? Where do you, go, bleh!
Let me touch a little bit on both of these. I think leading by example is also leading honestly and leading integrally. That's saying I'm not perfect. That's been a thing that we've created in our society where we want these examples to be perfect. I'm not perfect. I don't even lead that way. I don't want to start leading that way. And being honest about my humanity, being honest that I need breaks, that I need safe spaces, that I need time away. That's something that I think some of my predecessors in history and the culture has not always permitted, which is why we see such extreme stress that has been placed on leadership across all spectrums of leadership. But I also think I have family. I have a loving, beautiful wife. She's a physician. She's always working as well. But I have a beautiful son who's almost 3 years old, and I love
named
him.
Named after you,
Willie Bodger III. I've done my job. I passed it on. And I have brothers. My brothers are here, Winston, Weldon, and I have family. I have friends. I have friends that I create safe spaces with that I do love, and I am intentional about making sure that I have time to be healthy. Because what I've learned is that if you're not healthy, you can't be healthy for others. And COVID taught me that. I did so many funerals to the point where I was deeply exhausted. And thank God for some of the people in my church, some of the mothers and some of the elders. They pulled me to the side and said, Rev, you're doing a great job, but we want you to stay doing a good job. And at the pace you're going, you won't make it. And that was a early sign for me to say, all right, I need to reevaluate how I'm doing this. The Superman model does not work. And the hardest part is being able to tell people, we can't do this time because I'm not healthy or I'm not ready. I can't overextend myself. And I think that's a tough lesson. But I think, you know, it's made it better because when I have the capacity, when I am ready, when I am healthiest, I think I produce and we produce some of our greatest work.
That's Reverend Willie Bodrick II, Senior Pastor at 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. Reverend, awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tia. I appreciate it being here.
Stay with us. When we come back, we finish this special hour at City Hall with former acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey. I'm Tiziana Deering. You're listening to Radio Boston. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're bringing you a special hour today from our series, Stepping Up. For 5 weeks, we have talked with leaders in and around the greater Boston area who are making real change for their neighborhoods, their communities. And each conversation is keyed in on a specific moment or decision or approach to leadership as we look to explore what it takes to step up, what it costs those who do lead in their communities, what might be preventing some of the next generation of leaders from stepping up, and how we can help clear that path. Now, we bring you highlights from former acting Boston mayor Kim Janey, thrust into leadership as acting mayor from the Boston City Council, the first woman, first person of color to serve as mayor. So what does it mean to be asked to step up in a moment that turns out to be historic? And once you've made history, what do you do next to serve? When Janey joined us, I started by asking her whether it was fair to think of her as someone who was thrust into leadership.
You know, for me, I have always believed either you step up or you step aside. And in my family, in my community, I saw examples of leadership. I saw the ways that community leaders organized. Heard some of your earlier segment around busing. As you know, I was thrust into that as a young child. So I, you know, saw examples of leadership and what it meant to love your community and work for a better community. And so I kind of carried that with me throughout my career. In the nonprofit space, I have 25, 30 years experience working in the nonprofit sector, mostly here in Boston. I have taken that with me in elected office as I ran for District 7 City Council, Council President, and then serving as Mayor of Boston. I believe it is important for us to also look for and tap into a non-traditional leadership. And so I think, you know, leadership in Boston has looked a certain way, particularly if we're thinking about the highest office, serving as mayor. It has always been white. It has always been male. But there are community leaders in every single neighborhood who deserve to be recognized. They deserve to have their voices heard. And the things that they care about, we need to all make sure that there is space for different voices when we think about leadership.
So that's intriguing because you said a second ago or a minute ago, I believe you either step up or you step aside. Are you saying that it is actually time for some members of our community to step aside?
Well, I was not saying that. I was not saying that at all, but if this isn't for you, because you've got to have courage, you have to be willing to make hard decisions, you have to be willing to go where no one has gone before. And if that isn't you or something that you want to do, then yes, you should step aside and let those who are willing to take those risks, who are willing to kind of be courageous and take those first steps and blaze that new trail, then we've got to make room. And so I'm not necessarily saying that there are folks who are in the way who need to step aside. But I am saying it is important to recognize leadership in non-traditional forms. It's important to cultivate leadership, make sure that you are pouring back. I had a lot of folks throughout my entire life, folks who mentored me, who coached me, who cared about me, who offered sound advice. And to this day, you know, I turn to folks for advice, and I think we all do or should. And so it is important for those who have been in leadership to make sure that you are pouring into a new generation, for sure.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the people who've stepped up for you, supported you and mentored you. You know, as a young person, as an adolescent, I know there were people who wrote you off. You were pregnant at a young age. You have talked about kind of the culture of condemnation around that. You did not write yourself off.
No.
Who helped you have that strength?
You know, I think more than anyone, my daughter. I didn't have the luxury of being written off. I didn't have, even though people wrote me off, I couldn't let that be the end result. I couldn't let that be, you know, where I would end up because I had a daughter now. And so she really served as a motivating force to create better opportunities for her. And so I am grateful for all those who stood by my side and, you know, all my aunties and folks who were there. It's very difficult. I don't know how many of the listeners can relate, but being young, a teenager still in high school, scared, pregnant, you know, being told your life is over, feeling like your life is over, not, you know, knowing how you know, where you're even going to sleep the next day. You know, that things became very difficult at home. And so it was very difficult, but I'm grateful. I'm so grateful for the individuals who poured into me, who stuck with me, and for the institutions who were there for me.
Sometimes when I would talk to you when you were acting mayor, there are questions you want to ask that you either know, I can't ask it this way right now, or they're not going to be able to answer it this way right now, but we're in a different place now. And I find myself wondering sometimes, were there moments when you were serving as acting mayor where you felt like you were teetering on a ledge? You were going to make a big jump, but you weren't sure you were going to cross the distance from this side of the chasm to the other side with something you were trying to do. Did you ever have those moments?
Well, you know, leading the city of Boston was an amazing experience. I love my city. There are so many beautiful, wonderful things about Boston that are still true to this day that I appreciated throughout my life. That being said, it is challenging. You know, there is a lot of work. There is, and not just because it's a big job. There's a lot of work when your job is, or as you see your job, is to right many of the wrongs of the past. So, you know, there is a 400-year history of discriminatory policies that, you know, I wanted to tackle. Now, you can't do all of that in a couple of months. You can't do it in the span of a year. You can't even do it in a 4-year term. So, you know, what I am proud about is planting the seeds and starting that work and creating a foundation for that work to continue.
COVID, you know, police scandals, Patrick Rose, Dennis White, our great racial reckoning in the United States. You're standing in this moment with so much reform that needs to be done, so much you've decided to do. And I do wonder if you ever thought, kind of, darn it, why am I the one that's got to do all of this? There have been people in this role before me. Why am I having to try to do it all?
Well, you know, those are conversations I think you have with your creator. Like, those are conversations. Why me, Lord? You know, or, you know, if that's what you need me to do, then send me, Lord. You know, that is what I'm going to do. Many folks said, you know, at that time that, you know, this had to be from on high, because, you know, here you are thrust into this at this time when all of this is happening. And so this must be, you know, what you have been called to do. If that is the case, I mean, I think my calling certainly is related to, I don't know if I was specifically called to be mayor, but I guess so. I was specifically called to lead at that specific time my city. And I wanted to answer that call, and I wanted to give it my all.
So that idea of calling,
yes,
speaks to me. I understand that. And I wonder, so you're thrust into this role. You then ask to be given the role. The voters choose someone else. How did, looking back now, what's the train of thought there? So I was called to this role. It was an important moment. I stepped up in every way I could. But this is not what comes next for me. What happens in that moment?
Well, you know, I think for me, I have always tried to be very clear about the work, that it wasn't about titles, that we all have a role to play, and that the work is so big, the work has to get done. And so whether I am disrupting poverty as mayor of Boston, whether I am doing that through my advocacy for children in Boston Public Schools, whether I'm doing that in my new role as president and CEO of Empath, the focus has to be the work. And so that is what I believe my calling is. My calling isn't tied to specific titles, though now I've been racking up titles.
You have.
Doctor, mayor, president, CEO. It isn't about the titles. It is about the work. And for me, it is about how we strengthen our communities, how we provide supports for family and children, how we disrupt poverty and create opportunities using an equity lens for everyone in our city and our Commonwealth and our country. And so for me, the focus is about the work. And if as long as I stay focused on my calling and why I was created, my purpose in life, then I feel good.
Earlier in the conversation, you talked about some institutions that really stepped up for you when you needed it. Empath is the latest version of an organization that's been around a long time and that did step up for you.
Absolutely. And I am just so grateful to lead Empath as the new president and CEO. This organization has nearly 200-year history. Two important legacy organizations came together to form Empath. One was the Women's Educational Industrial Union, and the other was Crittenton. Mm-hmm. When I was that young teenager pregnant, it was Crittenton that provided services and an opportunity for me as a young pregnant teen to continue my studies, to stay in school, and to graduate with my peers on time. Back when I was in high school, which was a very long time ago, and it was very different. And so it was not typical to see pregnant teenagers in high school. Oftentimes, you had to quit school altogether. That was the end. As I said, people told me my life was over. But it was Crittenton that allowed me to continue my studies. So I took a semester. It was pretty much the semester from September to January of my junior year. And I went to school through Crittenton. I was able to continue my studies, my same courses that I was taking in high school at Crittenton. I had a lot of small group support around studies. And in addition to your academic work, they helped us with parenting. And so there were girls at Crittenton during the time that I was there from 13 all the way to 19. And maybe even 20, if you were still in high school. And so that was life-changing for me, life-changing.
So we have about a minute left. So what is a piece of wisdom that you gained from that life-changing experience that you're bringing into your service as the head of that organization now?
Well, it is the importance of giving people opportunity. It is the importance of mentoring and helping young people, helping young parents, helping parents regardless of their age. When you strengthen that family, you are strengthening community. And that is something that I learned after Crittenton, but as a young adult, as a young community organizer. And so leading in this new role, this organization that has a very unique model of direct service, of research and policy and advocacy, of economic mobility coaching and mentoring that really can take low-income parents and help them double their income in a short period of time. And so this is a proven method. We have a global learning network getting this word out all across the country, and I'm just so thrilled and grateful to be able to pay it forward and pour into new generations. Like was done for me. So
that is Kim Janey, who served as acting mayor of the city of Boston, the first woman, first person of color to do that, and is now CEO of the nonprofit organization Empath. Thanks for talking with us about stepping up.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great being here with
you. Great to have you. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening to this special hour. Tune in again Monday for more Radio Boston.